I want to say congratulations on your new position. And that
thank you, Madam Chair.
We're really going to miss you. We've really enjoyed working with you over the years and hope that we can continue to work with you as you take on this new challenge with the Bush Foundation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members. Susan Hegard, Director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And one thing I wanted to note, Madam Chair, is that when I leave in 2 weeks, I start with the Bush Foundation on March 1st, but Mark Mishkanis over here will be the acting director for the Office of Higher Education. So I'll be with the office for another 2 weeks, and then after that, Mark will be the acting director. I just wanted to make brief remarks. I think the most important folks for you to hear from today are the two systems, the two systems and then Capella. I think, are there three on the agenda?
Yes.
Capella. From those folks, because they're really on the ground doing this work. But I just wanted to give you some context about why the governor was interested in online learning. He became interested after visiting with Erskine Bowles. Some of you may remember him as, I think he was chief of staff to President Clinton some years ago, and he's now the president of the University of North Carolina. They were at a meeting with Governor Jim Hunt, former Governor Jim Hunt down in North Carolina, and Governor Pawlenty started talking with Erskine Bowles about the online learning efforts they were undertaking at the University of North Carolina, and they were being very, very aggressive at the University of North Carolina. Governor Pawlenty became interested, and I think what's interesting is that he, I think, saw this at first as a cost-saving measure. And then as he learned more and more about it, I think what he came to understand after the fly-around and talking with the folks who were doing this is that it really is an access issue. In the report Staying on Course, one of the important things to note is that the online education in the United States, 21.9% of all enrolled post-secondary students are taking at least one online course. And we've made that survey information available to you over here. Demand is growing whether we like it or not or understand it or not. Students are demanding it. At first, as I said, what caught the governor's eye was cost-saving, but I think he's learned that there are different aspects to this. One is that there are some upfront costs and challenges involved in delivering high-quality online courses. There's tremendous value in blended online classroom opportunities. So some of the approaches are blended and some are purely online. It really varies quite a bit, and you'll hear more about that today. There's access and opportunity online learning value for both high schools and for post-secondary education. So he challenged the University of Minnesota and the state colleges and universities to work towards a goal of delivering at least 25% of their credits online by 2015. And I think as you talk with a couple of the schools here today, Lake Superior, for example, and I think it was Bemidji, they already met that goal. So it's possible with the leadership to do that. And Minsky, my understanding is that I think 65% or so of their users of online learning are women. And 65% or so of their users are in greater Minnesota. And we heard some stories from these folks. They were basically said, I am a single mom. You know, I wanted to get my master's or finish my BA. And I couldn't have done it without having online opportunities because I have little kids at home. And I needed to be home with them. When they went to bed, I then got online. So it just presents just really, I think, some very interesting opportunities for people. This is not a passing fad. If it's done well, it's neither cheap nor easy. Folks from the university will, and Minsky will tell you that, Capella as well. And as I mentioned, it poses an incredible opportunity that we can embrace and lead on, or we can decide to watch other states, nations, and corporations eat our lunch. We're going to be adding an indicator for online learning to our Minnesota Measures Accountability Report. The governor mentioned that as part of his initiative. I think a couple other aspects of the initiative included requiring high school students to take at least one online course, and then asking our office to explore the possibility of reciprocity, online reciprocity with some other states.
Ms. Hegard, was that high school online course, was that expected to be a high school course or a college course?
Online course. I don't know. I don't think it had to be a college course. I think it could be a high school or a college course.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Hegard? Okay. Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, Ms. Hegard, wait.
Ms. Hegard, I'm not sure if you know these answers or not, but how does the cost of an online course compare to a course in person at the college?
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I think that's a question best posed to the folks from the university, to Minsky, and then also Capella. I think they could better answer that.
You want me to wait until they get up here before I ask the rest of these questions?
Well, I can try to answer them. It just depends on if they pertain, you know, to institutional costs and things. I wouldn't have that
like,
information.
Like, you know, completion rates and that kind of stuff? who really does the courses? Like, do the person taking the online course really do their own courses, or does somebody else do them for them? Or?
Those are questions.
I think those are questions. Right. Yeah,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as we have Ms. Hegarde, because her time is short now. It sounds like the governor and the administration, the more they look into this, are coming to some different conclusions. But is there, would you say, are there any cost savings aspects to looking into online learning? It'd be nice, of course, this year, if you say yes and give us a little more. But that's one question, and I just had one follow-up then.
Madam Chair and Senator Michelle, our understanding, at least in the research that we've done, is that there are some upfront costs and the systems can better respond to those. But down the road, I think Erskine Bowles and those who've had a longer tenure of experience with this have said that there are some savings that occur in terms of structure, buildings, capital, place that the learning can occur in different places and in different ways. And because of that, there are some savings when it comes to the capital side and buildings later on down the road.
You've already anticipated my second question, so thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, then we're going to move on and welcome Linda Baer from MNSCU, Vice Chancellor, and the MNSCU crew. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. I'm Linda Baer, the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Very pleased to be here to talk about online education. We plan to provide a brief overview of online learning in the system, as well as address a few of the topical questions that we received. Along with me is Dr. Patrick Opatz, Director of Minnesota Online, and joining us soon will be Barbara Bridges, a faculty member from Bemidji State University, and two students that we want to make sure you hear from, because they're the reason we're about this endeavor. This is why we do online, is to assist students. So Jill Henges and Brendan Babcock will be with us as well. So I'm going to try to be brief so that we can get to their discussions. The Minnesota State College Universities have been delivering online education for over 10 years. You have a handout in front of you that has some slides. Unfortunately, we weren't able to present the slides in here, but these would be the slides that would be answering some of your detailed data questions. Over the past 5 years, we've seen a large increase in the number of students taking online courses from one of our colleges or universities. And in fact, in the past 5 years, the number of credits generated has increased by 185%. So people are very interested in having this as one of their options in relation to going to school. The online student headcount has increased by 160%, with more than one in every four students taking at least one online course. Yes, some of these students are the ones who could not come to our campuses, and so they are taking totally online, but more of them, in fact, are already on our campuses, and they are taking it for convenience, flexibility, and to enable them to move through the coursework.
Vice Chancellor, in that count, do you include independent study courses where the students maybe submit written papers online by sending them by email to the instructor, or is that a separate category?
Chair Pappas, that would be a separate category. We'll talk a little bit about that, about the three ways or four ways we might look at what is enhanced by online technology.
Okay.
We have over 250 programs that are online, ranging from diplomas, certificates, associate degrees, baccalaureate, and graduate degrees. There are over 8,000 online course sections, including 6,000 online credits. So there's the data. There they are. 28 of our 32 institutions are offering at least one full program. Remember, courses build up to make programs, while all of our institutions deliver at least one course online. But that begs the point in a way, because students can take online from any of our campuses. In addition to delivery of a full array of courses and services, we have some very specific things.
Vice Chancellor Baer, let me interrupt you, because that was a very interesting point that you said, is that even though you're registered, say, at Metro State, you could still take an online course from Bemidji, and that those credits would then transfer over to Metro State.
Chair Pappas, correct.
Oh, interesting.
We're also partnering with the Department of Veterans Affairs to connect veterans, military members, and their families with educational benefits and resources to help them succeed in college through mymilitaryeducation.org and the Minnesota Online Support Center. So part of our call center opportunities about questions about services, questions about programs and courses, questions about how to access and be successful in online is residing there, and this additional service is going specifically to veterans. We're also enhancing our services to Minnesota businesses through new offerings in non-credit and customized training, especially currently in the areas of safety and compliance, but more to come in relation to that. And so we're pleased to be able to report that. As shown on the handout, would be slide 8, not only is the enrollment in strictly online courses going up, but so is the enrollment in other web-enabled delivery methods. And so what we're really talking about is, yes, the technology is there, and there are many ways of enhancing courses by using technology. And so more of them are what we're calling hybrid, where some is online and some is face-to-face. And we're finding that's a very beneficial way of doing education. But for some, again, it is the only way they can be attending is mainly through fully online. So we have blends going on. Web supplemental courses are courses that offer reduced seat time but are not considered totally online. The web enhanced incorporates substantial technology in the course, but seat time is not reduced, and that would be places where online chat might be going on, simulations, tutorials, help desk opportunities are going on online, but you're still in a course at the same time. We expect these blends to continue in the foreseeable future because we're still about delivering the very best we can for student success. Our colleges and universities provide services to their online students locally, including admissions, registration, bookstore, financial aid. So that's the college and university side of this. In addition, the system office provides a set of services to augment what the campuses are doing, things we can do better as in a group basis, as single service for all the campuses. So we feel that that's an efficient way to augment the local services and support the online learning. The primary service provided centrally is our learning management system, which is enterprise-wide. This was deployed 5 years ago and provides a common platform for all online courses to be delivered. Not only does the learning management system support the online courses, but it supports all courses. So this is what is allowing faculty to have full course syllabi online, full grading opportunities, full exchange and chat with students at any point in time, and a management of that course. It supports over 30,000 course sections at this time. Two-thirds of those are not considered to be online. So this is still part of the blend that's going on in our educational environment. Another central resource is Minnesota Online. You'll see in your handout a website picture of that, which helps to coordinate the delivery of online learning in the system. The Minnesota Online website, minnesotaonline.org, offers a single site for searching all courses and programs that are online in the system. Minnesota Online also works with all the campuses to provide access to information about all of the system's online services.
How long has that been up and operational?
How long
has Minnesota Online been up and operational?
Chair Pappas, that's been about 6 years.
Wow.
It also serves the purpose of bringing together our faculty to develop some online curriculum together so that we're coordinating curriculum development as well. Lastly, the Online Support Center provides a variety of call center services. We know actually that the most likely time that students might be online can be 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, a faculty member doesn't tend to be accessible at that time, and maybe tech support might not either, but that's when they may be doing their homework for one reason or another. And so we do have an online call center that's available to them to help them. What's planned for the future? Well, that's the best question we can be talking about here. What's planned for the future is even better service to our students, service-based to help them be even more successful online or on-site, more programs accessible to them in multiple ways, more transferability. But really, the future is going to be more mobile, more anytime, anyplace, anywhere in terms of the delivery, and more readily putting simulations and operations in the hands of these students so that they can test and retest and work on things to get better about their competencies. We also have several major health simulators across the state now that we've supported. And not only is it a benefit for students going through some of our allied health programs, but also we know that in some of our rural areas, the health professionals use these simulators to test themselves and work and practice on things they may have in a low incident way, but they can practice themselves and become even better at what they might be doing. So we expect we're going to integrate services better. We are working strongly with the University of Minnesota on some new academic innovations that I think Billy Wallstrom will be speaking about. We're working with the Minnesota Department of Education with some K-12 partnerships as well in terms of a learning object repository where modules of courses are going to be accessible to teachers and educators across the state. We're going to continue to build out our services to the military, especially returning veterans. And we expect that we will continue to improve the quality and flexibility of our offerings. In general, we plan to meet this growing demand for additional online educational services. We really don't see much of a slowdown. I think Lake Superior does have representation in the House. They may have seen a little plateauing, but that was a college that started early and went into the market fast and grew rapidly. And they're plateauing a little bit in some of what they're doing. But we're looking for more access, more affordability, and more success for our students. There are some advantages and disadvantages to online education. The advantages certainly come down to the accessibility, the convenience, the flexibility, the idea that we can be educating anytime, any place, that we can take it into a business industry as well and have ready access to training opportunities, more convenient, more time efficiency, and the opportunities for learning, including schools, programs, instructors, formats, all coming together in a resource repository. There are some disadvantages. Online education isn't for everybody. It takes motivation. It takes skill, literacy, technology literacy. We still have a digital divide in the state and the country, so not all have adequate and equal access to online opportunities. It does take an independent worker, an independent student, someone who can be disciplined and not necessarily rely on going to a class or having a timeline that's very, very rigid and lockstep for them. It's heavily dependent on text-based, though we are getting better about chat rooms and more interaction online. It's a different way of learning. It's a different way of learning, and it's not for everybody at this time. But I think we're getting better, and the disadvantages are beginning to go away more as we improve upon that technology. I guess I'd wrap up by saying the disadvantages mostly can be overcome by more improved professional development opportunities for our faculty and staff, which we continue to do. That a good teacher online is every bit the same as a good teacher on site. There can be bad teachers and there can be good teachers, but I think what we continue to do is improve upon the wonderful opportunities that our faculty are bringing to our students in the classroom. So I think that with that, I'd like to talk a little more just from what cost online and start with that, as Senator Tomasoni was asking. In regard to a cost study that actually Dr. Opatz performed in 07 for our board, we did conduct a cost study of online courses with the objective of determining if the cost of online delivery were more or less expensive than face-to-face. Basically, we found that it's about the same. It's comparable. It's comparable because the art and the science of educating is still very much an instructor interacting with a student, whether in a small classroom, a large classroom, or online. It's still an interaction going on. A statistical analysis was conducted and found that online was not necessarily a strong factor in predicting cost. Instead, it was the faculty member, senior faculty member, associate, or an instructor, the level of pay for the faculty member, the actual course itself, and how much was needed in terms of supplemental information and material, and also the institutional characteristics. The study also found that course development costs appear to be slightly higher for online, and that's often the case when you're initiating a new course. Non-instructional costs appear to be slightly higher simply because we're still at somewhat an infancy of online education, even though I've been online at 6 years old, in terms of assisting our students, assisting our faculty to be the very best we can while online. So with that, I would stand for questions, and also I can respond to your question about the governor's challenge as well.
It does seem a little bit counterintuitive that the cost would be the same because, you know, even though you have the technology cost and the course development cost, you don't have a building you know, that you have to heat and light. Do you have any insight into why that is?
Chair Pappas, a good question. And I think our trouble there is really figuring out those kind of cost factors. How much is it? There's a building that's there. It's being heated. What's the difference in the numbers of students we're serving in relation to the total number of students we have in our system? Because we have almost 400,000 students in our system. Mm-hmm. And so the 80,000 or so that might pass through one way or another online right now, they don't make a difference in not having this classroom open or
and
not having that building.
And the infrastructure cost.
Exactly.
Basic infrastructure cost.
Now, in the future, we may get to a different place.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that exact question, I guess maybe this is more hypothetical and it's still too new, but it would be nice if we could paint this picture that over time as we develop online capabilities, online infrastructures, as we get better and better at that, might the systems overall need fewer buildings? You know, I don't know if I'm talking about a substitute or a supplement, but I've actually had members of your board talk about how college is not so much about place anymore. You know, after World War II, when we did the GI Bill, it was about place, and we planted colleges all over the state. And so every 2 years before this committee and then before Senator Langseth's committee, there's a cost to that in the building, in the heaper, right? And so does the future of online in any way help us on that side of the cost of college? And then the next question is one that Senator Sharon and I have talked about, is online education going to deliver great education at a cheaper to our students? Are there savings to the students? So I'm looking for savings to the state, yes, please. But then also, can we look at it from a student standpoint as well? I know I've just thrown a lot at you, but...
Chair Pappas and Senator Michelle, good questions all around. And I think everybody across the country are facing those questions right now. What have we done as place-based education to date, and to what extent is it required that we still have the kind of space use we have? I think that's a first place to begin. We did the grand opening of a center of excellence, the first in the country, with Sun Microsystem yesterday at St. Paul College. And they showed us a virtual reality center where participants were on a screen virtually participating from all over the world in this conference. The other thing they showed us was a small notebook that is where they will be downloading all of the curriculum, and therefore they won't have a textbook for those courses in MetaUniverse, which is the development and design of Second Life universes. So there are things on the horizon for some courses. This is a computer science course, so it relates well, and they will, in fact, need to be able to operate in those ways because the very placement in the jobs they're going to be going to will require that of them. So in terms of what's on the horizon, I think that there will be changes certainly on the horizon. I don't know how predictable we can be right now about that. I do believe we can be more affordable. I do fundamentally think we can be more affordable, and we have taken that as a challenge to continue to work on. But the advantages to students who may not be able to get to campus are saving. In fact, some are saying online is the next green, that commuting isn't required, so you're saving gas. If you're a family person and maybe you don't have to do the daycare, you don't have to do residential, if you would have had that as your choice. Parking, a big thing. Parking. So, again, I would say we're there, we're developing, we're conversing about these things, and we know that there will be changes on the horizon.
Okay, Mr. Opatz, did you have something?
Sure.
Oh, sorry. Senator Latz.
Along the same line, I just happened to be listening and perusing a report by the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education, a conversation they had with presidents of universities. And one of the areas of consensus in there was that distance education, often mentioned as a cost saver, is seen as having only a marginal impact in that area. And it's consistent with what you're describing. But maybe somewhere down the road, we can expand the number of people accessing higher education, doing more or most of it online, than the marginal cost of those additional people taking courses that are already developed. might be lower overall for the institution. You might not need to build that additional dorm or that additional building or additional classroom space, but given the existing population, it's probably not going to be something we can count on to reduce anyone's budget right now.
Be one of the witnesses.
Okay, Mr. Opes, did you want to add
Chair
anything?
Pappas, I'm here just to support Dr. Baer.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Tomasoni. Okay,
I don't know. Are my questions for Madam? I'm wondering
direct
about.
Direct your question to Mr. Opes so he gets to say something.
Either one of you will know the answer to this one. I'm just wondering, you talked about the cost thing, and I'm with Senator Pappas. I think intuitively it seems like it should be cheaper and not cost the same. And I'm assuming eventually we'll get there. But do we have any kind of percentages of how many people actually complete these online courses as compared to people who go to class? Is it the same, lower, higher? And one other question is, how do you actually know that you're dealing with the person who signed up for the online course, and as opposed to their mother? Okay.
Or girlfriend.
Yeah.
Or kid.
Chair Pappas, Senator Thomas.
Mr. Opes.
In terms of the cost question, when we looked at that, or it's actually you're looking at, I think if you look at the completion, I'm sorry, completion rate. For all courses across the system, the completion rate is 93%, and we're looking at a student that successfully completes a course, and for all online courses, it's 89%. Well, we're seeing that as a challenge for online as a way to try to close that gap and finding ways of we're currently working with the Minnesota Online Council to determine are there additional resources or different strategies we could do to try to close that gap. In terms of the authenticity, in terms of the student taking the course, there are a variety of things. I know in the recent reauthorization, Higher Education Reauthorization Act at the federal level, the requirement was at least to have a username and password. That was the minimal requirement. We do that, so any student who is logging in will at least have to do that. We're also, in the ways we're really trying to do that in terms of our delivery is for the faculty member to decrease the number of actually tests that are taken that would require online tests. But if there's a different approach that could be taken where they would need to either be writing small writing assignments or larger writing assignments where it's really not just kind of a take-home test or a multiple choice would be to be a little bit easier to cheat on, but it's a little bit more elaborate. So I guess it's a little bit, I guess it's a variety of ways that we're trying to address the authenticity of the user. I don't know if Dr. Baer has
Madam Chair, is any of this like virtual classrooms? Are there cameras so that the professor sees the students and the students see the professor? Or?
Oh, Chair Pappas and Senator Tomasoni, yes. And, in fact, I think Dr. Bridges might be speaking to that in the example of what she's doing with her her online programming. But, yes, the See You, See Me, and, in fact, multiple screens, so you see more of the students, in fact. So it does begin to simulate more of a classroom. And so then that's another authenticity that, yeah, you're there.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Opets, are you related to Joe?
Yes, I am.
Kind of looks like him, don't you think?
Brother?
Yeah, he's my older brother.
Older brother, okay.
Senator Sharon.
I was curious, just emerged in my thinking as you were talking about whether or not online learning is more helpful for students whose English is a second language. Does the ability to take more time with things that are written or increase their ability to integrate and learn at their own pace?
Chair Pappas and Senator Sharon, yes, it can be more beneficial for people that are taking courses with English as a second language if, in fact, there are modules, tutorials, work that helps them go at their own pace. So exactly right. Plus, we have some translation capabilities so that when things may need to be translated, there's a little more time to be able to do that as well.
Okay, let's move on so we can hear from some of the practitioners.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourselves.
Chair Pappas and Senators, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm Dr. Barbara Bridges, and I'm a faculty member at Bemidji State University.
And I'm Jill Henches, student at Bemidji State University.
Okay, I'm Brendan Babcock. I'm a fast-track student at Bemidji State.
And what student?
Fast-track student.
Fast-track student, and you'll tell
I'll be
us
explaining
what
that momentarily.
Well, thank you so much for driving down. It's, what, a three-hour drive?
Actually, we're all here. Well, Brandon had a drive.
Yeah.
Where did you drive from, Brandon?
I'm almost by the Iowa line.
Oh, that's right. We're talking about online.
Yeah.
You're not.
This is
online.
Yeah.
Okay.
These are outreach programs.
I've done this virtually.
May I start?
Yes, please.
All right. I think that first of all, I can answer a lot of your questions, Senator Tomlinson. Tomasoni.
Online, you wouldn't have any problem.
Those were my concerns first. When they first came to me and said, well, how would you like to train teachers online? This is what I did. You know, I had grave concerns, but I'm happy to report that I've been in this for 8 years now. So I am the author, actually with Dr. Baer's seed money from a FIPSE grant, of something called Delight and Fast Track. Delight means distributed learning and teacher education. It's a hybrid program. Both these programs have face-to-face components. We meet 3 times a year to begin the semester, end the semester, then we start the spring semester, and then in May we meet to wrap up for a lesson plans and finals taken in front of the professor. So that's one answer to how we solve that problem. Delight is a K-8 teacher licensure program. Both these initiatives have a mentor in place. Every student chooses their own mentor, a practicing teacher in the community. I really think that that piece of the design has been part of the success of both these programs. Fast Track, we also have 16 community college partners from Minsku in the Delight program, of which Lake Superior is one of our strongest because they are the most wired. They were the first one that put a 2-year AA online, which enabled several of our servicemen, wives to complete their teaching licensure for when they came back to the States because they got their AA from Lake Superior and then finished with us in the Delight program. So that's an example of the kind of powerful partnerships that can exist in online. Fast Track is a partnership with the Minnesota Department of Education. When I saw the Alternative Pathways to Licensure office open, I thought, this is an answer for all these people that are calling me with a history degree they can't spend, with a philosophy degree they can't spend. You know, how can they become teachers without going back to school because they cannot quit their jobs? These are mid-range professionals. So we partnered with them. It's a dual portfolio. They come to Bemidji, again, that same 3 times a year face-to-face model for the pedagogy. That's how to teach. Then they prepare a portfolio for the Minnesota Department of Education on, for instance, their history background. So they know what they're going to teach, and here's the evidence of it. They took these courses, they had this experience, and then we certify them that now they know how to teach by taking the pedagogy sequence from us. Who are these people? Only less than 5% of them live within 60 miles from Bemidji. This is one of the real stickler points, and I think has been a point of conflict with the development of online learning. Because the campus people, you know, rightfully so, say that you're taking our students. These people never would have been campus students. These are mid-range professionals. 95% of them work. 85% of them have families. Lots of single moms that couldn't possibly quit their minimum wage job to go back to school to change their lives. And you mentioned Gina that the governor met up in Bemidji, and she's one of our students.
Ms. Hegard mentioned.
Oh, Ms. Hegard did, yes. So those are our students. I'm proud to tell you, and this is the way I know that what we're doing is working and the mother isn't taking the test, that all the students in both programs pass their praxis test on the first try, the pedagogy and the LEd. So these are educational testing service. These are the licensure tests that they have to take to become teachers. So if they were not getting educated in these programs, they would not be passing these tests on their first try. So I think that's, you know, clear proof that it's working. Even better than that, there's a glut of teachers right now in a little bit in elementary because, of course, the people my age with what's going on with the economy didn't exit as predicted because all their portfolios have decreased. However, even with that, my Delighters who are graduating with a K-8 are getting a 79% placement rate for those that are looking. Some of them aren't looking, but of those that are looking, 79% are finding a placement. Even better news for the fast trackers, 100%, I swear this is true, I did a survey of my people that graduated last spring. 100% of the people who completed the both the portfolio and the pedagogy sequence are teaching. This is the secondary program. So I thought that was really very exciting. Let's see. In terms of what other ways, would you like me to answer your question now, Senator?
Sure.
I do it a variety of different ways. In the way I have my program set up, the discussion board is really where the teaching and the learning and the interactivity go on. So I get to see their writing pretty much every day. We take in data by reading certain things, by doing activities. Then we go on the discussion board and we discuss them. So I get a real feel for what their writing skills are. So if all of a sudden a paper shows up and they don't match, I'm investigating that situation. I want to know how come this paper looks so much different than the quality of the everyday writing that I'm seeing from you. They do take quantitative tests. I teach a course called Foundations of American Education. A lot of that information is on those praxis tests. So I want them to have it. And, you know, if I wasn't being assessed, I wouldn't read the chapter. So I want to make sure they read the chapters. So they have to go on. It's a multiple choice and short answer, but I don't give them enough time to look it up in the book. So they have enough time, if they've read it and they have the information, they can answer it.
It's a time test online.
It's a time test online. And, I've gotten to the place where I know how long it takes them if they've read it. Mm-hmm. So there really isn't any way to cheat on those. And they have to take the final. And, again, if they do really well on the online quizzes and then they come and bomb my final when they're sitting in front of me, I don't like it. That's also Dr. Google knows all. And if I'm worried about any kind of plagiarism in the paper, I'll just lift out an unusual phrase and let Dr. Google. And they all know if I catch them cheating, they're out. No conversation, nothing. I mean, call me crazy. I don't think cheaters should be teachers, you know. So does that answer your questions about the who's taking the tests and how I feel that it's authentic? Okay, good. I think that's my 2 cents.
All right, great. Well, let's hear from the students.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, like I said before, my name is Jill Henches, and I'm very proud to join you today as a student of Bemidji State University's Distributed Learning in Teacher Education, or DELIGHT program. I'm a Minneapolis public school kid, a graduate of the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication, a marketing professional, and currently I'm the community outreach coordinator for Metro Transit. So, one might ask, what am I doing in this hybrid online teacher licensure program for elementary and middle school? I have wanted to teach since I was in a 10th grader in Mr. Greenhagen's class in the former West High School in Minneapolis. As often happens, my path took a turn toward more earning potential, and before I knew it, my dream was in the rearview mirror, but never completely out of sight. In 2006, the dream came into focus again, when I was in a position to return to school, but only if I could continue working. In the Metro, I had many choices of education programs, so I began to shop around. Not only does the Bemidji State program offer the rigorous coursework, high-caliber faculty, and the substantial time in the classroom I was looking for, but for my degree, it could be earned nearly entirely online, so I could balance my career and my school. With my initial bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota, I've been using Metro Transit vacation days to substitute teach in my mentor teacher's classroom in Minneapolis Public Schools. I started teaching her students as 6th graders, and this year they are a team of 8th graders. I am one of the only substitute teachers that these students have known. It's an amazing bit of continuity, not only for myself, but for those students. This semester, 7 of my classmates and I were selected for the Minnesota Service Cooperative's online internship program through a MinSCU iSEEK grant. I am paired with a Minneapolis Public School online teacher, and am using my foundation as an online learner to develop skills as an online educator. All of these opportunities are supported by this important online program. Thanks to the Bemidji State University DELIGHT program, I will graduate May 8th with no debt. I will finally fulfill my dream of becoming the kind of teacher who inspired me back when I was in 10th grade. My classmates, living in all areas of this state, each have their own stories to tell. No two stories are the same, but each of us shares a common desire to teach, and each of us found this online program as the way to fulfill that dream. On behalf of my classmates, past graduates, and future teachers, thank you for your continued support of online education.
Thank you for that very inspiring testimony. Appreciate it. Any questions for Ms. Babcock? Ms. Hengis, sorry.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I may date myself, but is there still a practice teaching element to being
Absolutely.
A teacher?
Absolutely. Okay. Madam Chair and Senator.
And then how do you do that?
Certainly. Madam Chair, Senator,
sure.
It's still very traditional in its student teaching. We in the program will student teach as traditional teacher students do at the end of our program, and that does require that I take the 2.5 years worth of vacation that I've saved for Metro Transit to take 12 weeks off.
Okay.
So, and I'll be doing that in the fall.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Ms. Henches, your name is pretty familiar for people in this building.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad you have your father's passion for public policy, but not his looks.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Hengis,
Senator Michelle, I think that I look quite a bit like my father. And it is true, I'm the eldest daughter of Bob Hengis.
Oh, very nice.
He meant it as a compliment.
I did.
Okay, now, Mr. Babcock.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I represent extreme rural Minnesota, and that'll come a little bit into my story. I also hopefully will be remembered for the face of unemployment in Minnesota. I'm in the middle of a career change. I'm actually a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, and I've worked for the last 17 years with the highest of risk youth in the public school systems and also treatment centers. And I went to work at Fairmont Area Schools in 1997 with a group of professionals that wished to develop some innovative in-house prevention activities for alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use in concert with the education. Because we're all aware of the high dropout rate and the impact on society when kids don't graduate and go on to some other behaviors. Because of the downturn in the economy and a lot of other things, all the prevention dollars went away. And we were able to find grants, and we were able to hang on and continue my work at the school. But finally, it's just about a year ago now, I was finally laid off, found myself unemployed, and became eligible for some displaced worker money. And with the encouragement of my local school folks and the team that I'd worked with there for years and years, finally decided to go back to school. But again, the idea is if I would have had to have traveled to a traditional campus, if my place in life and with kids and dogs and cats and everything else that we got going on, it just wouldn't have happened simply. And I want to make sure I mention the cost piece, too, because as far as cost to the student and my ability to participate in this, I couldn't do it any other way. There's just no way. So I will end up ultimately with a degree in special ed. I will have a specialty area in emotional and behavioral disordered students. That's really where my passion is. I'm going to do this a little differently. I'll participate in all the fast-track programming where I will get all the requirements and the tools that I'm required to have to teach in the state of Minnesota. But I'll go on and I'll complete some coursework online through Bemidji State in the special ed area. And that it'll take me a little longer. I think I'm still looking at about 18 months, 2 years, that kind of thing. I really found this program due to some marketing that they had done. And the one thing I will say about Bemidji, and I can only speak to Bemidji's program, I have yet to have a bad experience. Now, as I told you, with my background as a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, I work with problem people. I also interface with many agencies that deal with problem people and can become very difficult to work with. I have yet to have a bad experience. So however they've got this set up, the people are designed to work with alternative learners such as myself. I can get any answer I need. I can sit in Huntley, Minnesota, which is where I'm from, talk to the folks in Golden Valley, also up in Bemidji, and get anything solved right now, which is highly unusual. I think you don't get that even on an mm-hmm. on-campus mm-hmm. situation. So that's what brought me here. I'm into my second semester. I survived the indoctrination that took place. There's quite a learning curve here. And through the paces that Dr. Bridges put me through, I'm now her teacher's assistant for human resources. And that's the other piece. I'm allowed to take my expertise in the alcohol and drug area from 17 years worth, and she's invited me to put together some curriculum that we're now teaching together in the human resources classes. And I'm reaching out to 90 students, you know, and that's an opportunity I wouldn't get otherwise either. There's just no way. So I can't say enough about it. It's not for everybody. You know, I'm an older person, and I've got skills, and I've been around, and I've needed all those to interface with this correctly to get the product which I want, which is a special ed license here in about another year and a half. And if you're wondering about holes and gaps and what's out there, I'm going to be getting licensed in an area which is your number one need in the state of Minnesota, bar none, in terms of the qualified professionals that aren't out there and the sheer number of students that you're going to need to serve in the next 10 years that are emerging with emotional and behavioral disorders. And an awful lot of those come from unresolved mental health issues and also undiscovered alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use. So I'm pleased about the whole thing. It's yeah.
Well, Dr. Bridges, it sounds like to me that even though we do have kind of too many elementary school teachers to be employed, that your students who are mid-career, who come with a greater background and more maturity, it sounds like they're still in very much in demand in a school district.
Chair Pappas, you really hit the mark in terms of their mature status. They're worried that they're too old, but from an administrative point of view, really, you know, they're perfect because they don't have to raise them. They're all raised, and they get them at an entry-level salary. So, you know, I think that the jobs have been scarce, but the ones that are out there, my students are getting them. But also, they're coming with a skill set that's almost as good as being the soccer coach now, because they come in with being able to participate and help them develop curriculum for online teaching. And just to make it clear, this program, both these programs, are exactly the programs that exist on the Bemidji campus. The only difference is the delivery methodology. Mm-hmm. You know, I see it as a different menu. You know, you've got the same learner objectives, and you have a different menu. So, and by the way, the attrition is less than 20% in these programs.
Once they're employed?
No.
No.
When they come into the program, it's less than 20. We have less than 20% drop away from the beginning to the end.
Okay.
It's a cohort model. Mm-hmm. So usually the cohorts go through, and you know, as Jill will tell you, that you get very close. It's surprising. They only see each other 3 times mm-hmm. a year. So they only see each other 9 times in the whole thing. But they feel, I don't know.
Do you have communication online between face-to-face meetings with among your cohort?
Mm-hmm. Oh, daily.
Madam Chair, it is absolutely amazing how close you do become. I wouldn't have believed it with these folks who live all over Minnesota, and some of my dearest friends now are my classmates. And it's, you know, maybe it's because you're both in the classroom. I call it in the classroom. You can see who's in the mm-hmm. classroom with you. Maybe it's because you happen to be up at 2 a.m. one night for whatever reason, and you're there together and you have a chat, or you're working through a group project. We still have group projects. We're working on group projects mm-hmm. together. But during the course of this program, you become incredibly close, not only with your fellow students, but then also the faculty, because we have such direct access to the professors, more so than in a traditional classroom.
The question came up, I think, earlier about is there any visual contact?
There can be. And with the advent of the new technologies that are coming in, server space has been an issue. Because anytime you want to move or put pictures up, that's taking more bandwidth. But with the advent of YouTube and Wikis and WebEx, we meet in WebEx accounts where you can see each other. What you'll find is before you come into this world and become the culture of online, you think that visual sight is really, really important, and I used to think that. Mm-hmm. I think it's less important now. I don't know if you two would agree with me in terms of actually being able to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
It seems less important to me than it did 8 years ago when I first started this, because I was dreaming for the time that we'd be able to be like the Jetsons and talk to each other, you know? Mm-hmm. And that, like I said, that seems less important. But with the bandwidth issue has always been the issue.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, for those of us who are rather intimidated by some of the new features on the computers, do you have a program that trains and teaches people to become more comfortable with how to take an online course? Is there something like that available?
Because it's a cohort model, we, as a matter of fact, this weekend we're having a new Delight cohort start. So they come for the whole weekend, and the first, you know, half of the day is spent orienting them to Desire to Learn, which is the MinSKU course management software. We have a whole netiquette thing that we do. We tell them you're entering a new, like a new country. You need to learn a new language. You need to learn a new way that you operate, mm-hmm. just as if you were going to Spain. You wouldn't go there without learning what kind of the rules of the culture were. So we definitely help them with that. We also have an incredible support at Bemidji, the tech support. I'm strictly a driver. I'm no techie. I mean, the people who've known me all my life, I was 20-year art teacher in the K-12 schools before this, find it hilarious that I'm, that I've ended up here. I'm strictly a driver. I am no techie. So the techies do their job at Bemidji, if you don't they? If you have a problem.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you can't break the system. You just jump in. You know, I mean, that's, and I have a fair amount of computer experience, but at some point you just have to dive in and play with it, and the support is great. And that's another way that we interact as fellow students. You know, we're on the phone continuously with one another.
Do students generally have computers that are adequate, or do you recommend upgrades that are might be necessary?
I keep dreaming that I'm going to get a Bill Gates grant, you know, and give them all the nicest, fastest computers. It used to be more of an issue than it is now because so much of it's placed on the web, so you don't have to worry about your own equipment as much. There are people that, like Dr. Baer said, who cannot participate in this program because they don't have any computers. They're getting cheaper and cheaper. If you have $500 now, you know, you can get in. I have several students who are recent immigrants who go to the library. Mm-hmm. They're in this program, and they do it at the library.
Oh.
So.
I would add that,
Ms. Bridges.
Madam Chair, that we do, there is a minimum requirement, and then you learn pretty quick. I started out with dial-up saying, oh, dial-up's okay for me. Well,
yeah,
I mean, you learn into the program that, you know, some very modest improvements can really improve the overall experience. But you can do it with very minimum, you know, technology, but it's more pleasant if you have a bit faster service.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Textbooks have been a big cost to students in the past. So do you have textbooks,
yes.
Or is your course textbook free?
Dr. Bridges.
Chair Pappas.
Yeah.
I'm trying to follow protocol here. Jill coached me before we came. Yes, Foundations of American Education, like I said, is one of the core courses that they're going to be tested on at the end of the program. So I tell them that they, and I use a very standard in the industry, it does have a test bank, that's where the quizzes come, so I don't create the quizzes. Because after all, those tests come from the mainstream sort of framework. And so it's a rigged game, and I'm the guide on the side, as these both will tell you. I am not on the sage on the stage. I believe in constructivism. I don't stand up and lecture. But it's a rigged game to tell them we can all have fun and hug and, you know, then send them off to take a standardized test someplace. So they do have a textbook in my class. They have a textbook in EdPsych. Wolfric was another standard in the industry. You know, we're big on that. I don't use textbooks in human relations, which Brendan is TAing for me this semester. We do selected readings and a couple of novels. So it's according to the course, you know, and what the outcome is. You know, I decided that when I that I agreed to develop these, that they were going to have the competencies that they needed. You know, I wasn't going to have them go to Praxis 2 and fall on their faces. So.
Okay, any final questions? Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the students, what applicability would you see for high schools for online learning? Obviously, in PSEO, other dual choice options, high school students are taking some online courses. Should we encourage this trend as well? The governor wants 25% higher ed. It's a continual system.
Sure.
Your suggestions.
Sure.
Ms. Sanges.
Madam Chair, Senator, I was just selected to participate in this internship program. So I'm 1 week into the internship with the Minneapolis Public Schools, but I am already into their online classroom and looking around at the curriculum and reading some of the students' work. And I would say that what I've read and what I'm hearing, you know, the brilliance starts in in the universities and the colleges and then moves its way down. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't continue on with not only high school, but then to middle school as well. And it's a whole, I think it's a different range of challenges for those high school students. Some are taking credit makeup. Some are maybe in a hospital or they have other medical reasons why they can't be in the traditional classroom. So there's a variety of reasons that are different than the ones we face in the university. But still, the short answer is yes.
I have one comment on that from rural Minnesota again, Madam Chair and Senator.
Mr. Babcock.
We have to think about the barriers that are out there. You know, not only for my daughter who had, what, 3 or 4 snow days here in the last 2 weeks where she didn't go to school, and that's going to be a budget issue down there for Grenada, Huntley, East Chain. She could have been in school, you know, during some of those days. She was also screened in to participate in the University of North Carolina pilot study that they're doing for rural outreach. So, I'd like you to keep the rural folks in mind as well. But also, as I mentioned earlier, folks that haven't done so well with school. Again, where I work with, I work with mothers and children that are living in a meth recovery house right now. They're very limited in what they can access. They could do very wonderfully with online learning, and I think this is especially applicable for the at-risk folks that have dropped out of school. And the folks that have really struggled with this, I think it's a wonderful opportunity at the high school level.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then we'll dismiss the panel and welcome folks from Capella University. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourselves for the tape.
Great. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Kassir, and I am serving as the president of Capella University. I'm joined by Christine Johnson. Christine, what's your title again today? Director of...
My name is Christine Johnson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Capella University.
Great. I want to start first by apologizing because I'm turn 45 and I'm struggling with my new bifocals, so if I flip them up and down, it's because I'm trying to adjust to this new reality. what I hope to do is share with you a little bit of an overview of who Capella is and why I think we're doing something quite incredible. And I'm really delighted and excited by some of the commentary I heard from my colleagues throughout the past 45 minutes to an hour, because it does portend an exciting trend in our ability to serve more and more folks who are desperately in need of access to higher education. Capella is, as you will note in some of the statistical documents which Christine shared with you, we are now the third largest university by number of learners here in Minnesota. We serve learners in every state in the United States and in 55 countries around the world. We were named, once again, one of the best places to work in Minneapolis. So, in short, I believe we're not only a great and emerging university, I think we're also a great organization with a lot to offer. And it's time for us to begin to explore ways to better collaborate and participate and be a stronger citizen in the state. But what perhaps is the most compelling part of Capella is really our mission. And our mission is about extending access to higher education for adult learners. The adult learner piece is very important to us because I heard the term earlier, pedagogy, which by definition is about child learning. Our focus is really on adult learning, and those are in fact two very different things. Second, we make a fundamental commitment and investment in the idea that there are no limits to human potential, that we have no real idea what any individual can possibly achieve, and that every adult has a right to a chance to succeed at higher education. It doesn't mean that everyone will. It doesn't mean that online is right for every type of learner, but we do have a responsibility to recognize that what a 40-year-old adult learner who is, on average, the age of our learner at Capella, what they did in high school may not at all be predictive of what they can achieve in college. So there are some real questions here about how we think about education and how we focus on adult learning and its importance. Capella, I believe, has a critical leadership role. We continue to focus fundamentally on quality, superior learning, and a superior learning experience. As I share with my students personally, Capella goes down on my resume, and I am fundamentally focused on one thing, and that is making sure that every single one of you graduates with a great education. Because if I don't, then that's where my accountability lies. So I am not distracted by anything else but the focus on creating a great educational experience and a great learning experience for the learner. And our challenge and our job collectively is really about looking at what the needs are of the workforce of tomorrow and how to build globally competitive learners who can participate in a workforce that is increasingly challenged by investment by other countries that, quite frankly, I don't think we're making. And I don't think we have done a great job as a nation in investing and ensuring that the value of education is in the forefront of how we think about investment and growth and the needs. I will say that a important byproduct and a fact that's really interesting to me is that we manage and we lead and we communicate in a very dispersed world. All of us have grown up sitting in front of a box, watching television from Sesame Street to Electric Company, to watching the news, to learning through technology. But somehow, when it comes to education, this becomes a difficult concept for us to think about, expanding that idea, investing in it, and growing it in a different way. What really distinguishes Capella is hard to put into words or to capture here and share with you. It's something I think you often have to, I really do believe you have to step inside and really suspend disbelief and look at from the inside out, and that is the incredible passion that exists within the people at Capella, faculty, staff, everyone, for really serving the mission of creating great education. I mean, it's palpable, you can touch it, and it is in the very front of how we think about what we're doing and its importance. The other part is to talk about our philosophy of education, and our philosophy, you've heard me talk about access as part of the mission, but it is really about investing in human potential and about providing opportunities for people who may not necessarily think they have a chance to succeed. Second is that we don't apologize for bringing the best of business thinking together with an academic learning model and exploring the tension and the synergy and the opportunity that creates to build something different and new. And third, as a professor, and I spent most of my career as a traditional academic at the Carlson School for many years and then at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., what really speaks to my heart the most about what we're doing is that we focus on, and I don't know a better way to say this, but we garden learners in, we don't weed them out. When you're dealing with an adult learner, and 68% of our learners are women in their 40s who have children, responsibilities, family commitments, there are a lot of things that can get in the way of getting a great education. And time is perhaps the most important commodity for a working mom who's trying to get her education and manage a family and juggle a career and do all of those things. At Capella, we surround our learners with teams of people to help them deal with life challenges and other issues, and we specialize in it, so that we get fundamentally focused on assessing academic competency to move forward and issues of, oh, my child is sick or, you know, I'm having trouble at work. Those aren't necessarily the reasons why somebody has to stop their education. It's really about getting focused on whether they are demonstrating competency to move forward in the course room. And we have a real commitment to ensuring that we assess competency throughout all of the work that our learners do. So those are really critical and important pieces. A fourth point, because I could probably, you know, talk the ears off a brass monkey about why I think this is important and who knows how credible that would be coming across, but the real issue is accountability. And when you look at the results are very strong. Capella is a member of the AQIP program as part of the Higher Learning Commission. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's the Academic Quality Improvement Program that is a continuous quality improvement process. We were among the first institutions to voluntarily sign up for that. So instead of a 10-year review process, we are in a constant review process of submitting reports on quality improvement work that's going on in our institution on an annual basis. We are the only university that is online in the United States that continues to hold something called the KCREP accreditation for our mental health counseling programs. We have a mental health counseling program at Capella that has the gold standard seal of approval from the KCREP organization. Those students who graduate from our program learning mental health counseling online are eligible to sit for licensure in many states around the country. So, again, another proof point. We are designated as an institution by the National Security Agency and Homeland Security for providing education to learners who are affiliated with the government in those areas. We are the partner for the FBI Leadership Academy. In fact, the head of the FBI Training and Leadership Academy is a Capella graduate and has recently published a book called Graduate Savvy. So there are a number of proof points here which are really critical that you don't have to listen to me try and sell you something, but instead look at the data and look at the evidence on what we're creating here and what the outcomes are of the work that's happening at Capella. In my own personal experience, I heard some comments made about, you know, authenticity and how you know who's on the other side and how great learning can occur. And I was going to say something else as part of this discussion today as a prepared remark, but I feel obligated as a taking off my president hat and talking more as a teacher and tell you that I, too, had skepticism coming to a place like Capella about is it possible to really create great learning. And I'm excited about stepping in and seeing how this can be done. And the reality is that every learner at Capella has to interact with their faculty member every single week. So while we use the term asynchronous learning, the reality is that every learner every week has assignments. They can finish those assignments when it fits for their schedule, but every week they must interact with every faculty member. They must interact with at least three learners every single week. And so as a professor, I've watched a level of intimacy be created that I never could create in the course room as a traditional professor. And I will share it candidly, and it might be my own weakness as a teacher, but really at the end of any semester in a classroom of 20, I don't think I actually got to know more than about five people in the course room. You know, and the others, you know them, but what do you really know? And the reality is, in online, you actually get to create, you force a level of interaction and intimacy. And what could be more vulnerable than to write down what you think and share that with others and have it made public and have to respond and address that? So there's something incredibly powerful here, which is challenging our basic ideas about how great learning occurs. And the technology is raising new questions that I think we're collectively responsible for looking at and asking. So for me, it's important to say that while it might seem like online without a visual could be a challenge, when you look at the evidence and when you look at the quality of learning and you look at the quality of relationships that are being created, when I look at my own job or perhaps some of the jobs you're doing, how many people's lives do you have to touch without ever getting the chance to be in front of them? It's about how to manage, how to lead, how to communicate, how to interact, how to engage, how to promote learning. All of it happens at a distance and in a dispersed way. And the skill set to be able to do that also happens in the learning environment at Capella. So those are a couple of things I wanted to share with you about who we are and what we're doing. I will also note that our courses are designed fundamentally and aligned with all of our courses across all of our programs, serving all 24,000 of our learners in five different schools. PhDs, masters, and bachelors are aligned with competencies. So everything, the competencies that the professional associations, the employers, and the academics expect people to be learning. And then every unit that's taught every week in a course is tied to some professional competency expectation that a learner is expected to achieve in some degree program at Capella. So, and it's balanced so that there isn't one week where you have 20 hours of work to do and another week where you have two. The target is to try and create an environment that's sensitive to the adult working professional's needs and to have a unit that's 4 hours a week in time commitment as opposed to 20. So everything is aligned with competencies, it's aligned with expectations, and everyone is held accountable. As an administrator, I can tell you, no faculty member at Capella gets to shut the door on their classroom and instruct. I know everything. I know what all the interactions look like. I can study it on a moment-to-moment basis. I don't have to wait till the end of the semester to go back and see what the course evaluations say. I can go in at any time and both monitor and look at what the interactions are that are happening. I can study the relationship between those interactions and how learning occurs, and I can look at ways to improve the learning experience. I'll say one last thing, again, because I can talk a lot, and I apologize for that, but the real success is in the success our learners are having professionally in the workforce. And I'll share two quick stories with you, and you have a number in your folder, but I'll share two others because one of them I have a personal relationship with. One of our recent graduates in our health administration program at the PhD level graduated with 74 peer-reviewed publications and became a full professor and endowed chair, the first endowed chair in patient safety in the country at Texas Tech University in Texas. That is at a traditional university, never has been an assistant professor, never has been associate professor, went right from graduate student to fully tenured professor and the first endowed chair in patient safety in the country. The second is we had a learner also in Texas, and maybe there's something about Texas going on, but who finished her dissertation in accounting and won best dissertation of the year in the state of Texas when compared to all other dissertations in the state. So there's something going on here at Capella. There's something about my alignment fundamentally with the student, with the adult learner, with our focus on understanding how great learning occurs, our investment in technology, our willingness to take some risks and really study learning and monitor what we're doing and share the results with others. And it's now time as a young organization in Minnesota for us to step out from behind the scrim because I think we brought it as far as we can without creating partnership and collaborating with other institutions to really understand how to do this extraordinarily well. So I'll stop there and say thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you today.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, did you have any comments you wanted to make? Or
Madam Chair, no, I'm here for support as well.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? I wanted to understand, of your students, you have 9,421 FTE. What percentage of those live in Minnesota?
I believe the number of students in Minnesota is approximately 1,000.
Okay. Fairly small. And when you say that 77% receive financial aid, is that institutional financial aid from Capella, or is that from their Pell Grant eligible?
Yes.
Basically a Pell Grant
yes.
eligible, because mm-hmm. that's everyone.
That's everyone.
And then some of your 1,000 students in Minnesota, some could qualify for financial aid here.
That's correct.
Although I don't believe we provide financial aid for master's degrees. So it would be the undergraduate, which is fairly small,
right.
your program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other people? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What approximately is your ratio of student learners in a course to staff?
Dr. Kassirer?
Kassir,
thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We work toward we call it section balancing, so that there is one faculty member for every 20 learners in a course room. So no section is larger than 20 students at Capella.
Other questions? Well, thank you very much. I think there aren't questions because you were very comprehensive in your comments. And we really appreciate you coming to see us today. And congratulations on your successful and a prize.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much for having us.
Okay, next on the agenda, we have Jennifer Weil from MSUSA.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for allowing us to the opportunity to come and speak to you. Kelly Ash, who was, I know, originally on the schedule to speak, he had a conflicting meeting, so that's why he's not able to be here today. Like I said, my name is Jennifer Weil, and I serve as the Vice Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I'm here today to talk briefly about online education. Online education has been an amazing development in the worlds of technology and education. People who have never been able to access higher education can now obtain it. It has been especially helpful for citizens across Minnesota who are either too far away from a campus to attend classes or who have families or other work commitments that make it difficult to pursue more traditional higher education. In addition, online education has opened up more educational opportunities for other traditional students as well, giving them options to take courses from campuses other than their home campus. Students serve on several system-wide committees that develop online courses, online course direction, as well as work to continually improve online academics and student services. There are a few points I would like to address today regarding online higher education, especially in light of the governor's recent proposal to significantly increase the number of online courses offered. First, while online education is an important piece of higher education, it may not be right for everyone. MSU serves many populations, including first-generation college students, displaced workers, underserved and underrepresented students, and we wonder whether they are able to obtain the student services they need to be successful. We want to ensure that students have multiple options and are able to choose the learning environment that is best suited for them. Secondly, it is our impression that there are some concerns with the ability to provide remedial or developmental courses online. Certainly, the need for these courses continue to exist, and students' success in these courses can determine their ability to succeed in future higher education. We would want to ensure that the needs of these students are met. Finally, the tuition for many online courses in our system is more expensive than tuition for courses on campus. As you know, affordability of higher education is the student's primary concern, and we would like to continue to discuss how we can make online education more affordable and accessible for students. At this time, I'd be willing to take any questions.
Are any? Did you just say it's more expensive online?
It is more expensive. Not for all of our institutions. Some institutions charge the same for courses online and courses on campus, but some institutions charge more. And for the institutions like the universities that we looked into, it's roughly about $50 in addition for per credit for an online course.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Latz.
Yeah, have you inquired as to why?
Chair Pathis Center. I know that creating online courses, it's a very costly process. As far as the details, I'm not qualified to be able to answer those. So they'd be better directed to those universities and system.
Senator Wieger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weil, do you think the 25% goal the governor set for credits available is realistic?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that it is definitely possible. I think our general concern as students is that the quality is met and that the academic quality of the courses that students are receiving online is comparable to that of the classroom, and that also those student services continue to be at the level that the students would need in order to be successful in those courses.
Madam Chair, a follow-up. Okay. Could you elaborate further on the concern on quality?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think as far as quality, I know that there's many steps that are taken to, as far as like how the courses are executed, just making sure that there's checks and balances and that those are continually being reviewed to make sure that the way that the courses are displayed and presented to students is in the best way for them to learn. And I know that for some courses, Depending on, like if you were taking an education course, it might be more beneficial in that case for those students to be in class because of the interaction that is necessary. So it really, I mean, I think it would depend, too, as well on the major and the course.
Okay, thank you very much. Then we have Mr. Tom Sullivan from the University of Minnesota. Welcome. Do you want to introduce yourselves again for the tape?
Madam Chair, I'm Tom Sullivan, Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost at the University of Minnesota, and I have my colleague with me this afternoon, Dr. John Finnegan, who is the Dean of our School of Public Health, who will, at the end of my remarks, give you a commentary on the blended education and the balancing and integration that he sees within his own college, in this case of public health. I commend you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, for your timeliness on this hearing, because this month's issue of the prestigious Science Journal actually is devoted to education and technology. And to quote the editor of the journal, he says, there is no better time to look at the art of education through many different lenses. And I think that's the purpose of the committee's inquiry today. I would like to, with your permission, focus on three different themes, and I hope my remarks will be complementary and supplemental to my colleagues who have preceded us this afternoon. First, I would like to just outline where my remarks will be going. First, I think it's important to talk about some definitions, about methods and varying opportunities for education, the delivery, of course, the costs associated, the constituents involved, and the market impact and realities. First, those three themes that I think underscore my remarks. First, different students learn differently. And the reasons here are many. Generational, the nature of the study area, the nature of the ultimate job, and the experience that that will entail. Second, operationally, the balance that's necessary in teaching as well as the delivery systems for this magical thing that we've all been talking about this afternoon, the teaching and learning experience in the classroom, how one defines the classroom. And third, the context, the contextual relationship of the institution's mission. In our case, of course, the university mission is one of providing educational opportunities in the context of a rich research university. So those three things, those themes will underlie my remarks this afternoon. The university has been offering courses in alternative forms for over 100 years, from the correspondence courses that some of us may have heard as we were going through a couple of years ago, to the more recent, of course, electronic delivery of courses, even in our high schools. Specifically, the university has had online courses for the last 12 years, since 1997. E-learning is a comprehensive term used to describe technology, a technology-rich environment, which includes the delivery of the instruction and actually the instructional materials as well, both to students on campus and students off campus. It's not just about online learning. It's broader, it's more comprehensive, and it's about shifting teaching styles and materials and methodologies to deliver them directly, that so that we can see this dynamic that we call teaching and learning. And of course, the end product. You, this committee, had an opportunity a year ago, I think, to visit our campus and see one of these dynamic educational opportunities in electrical engineering. And I know next Tuesday you're going to be touring the campus again to see how the interaction of the technology, education, and the learning experience are taking place. A couple of examples, if I might, as we go through. One of our most dramatic examples, which you will see on your tour next week, is the laboratories in which we teach dentists through the high state of technology, enriched environments with a very complex state-of-the-art simulation experiment and equipment. I actually went through and spent about 3 hours myself about 4 months ago in this dental lab, and I think you're going to be just simply dazzled by the state of the art in using technology to teach today's and tomorrow's dentists. In the material that we've handed out, we're going to be discussing a few terms, definitions, the learning platform. It's really our approach to integrating many of the independent and different applications into a unified, coherent system for teaching as we look at a blended opportunity, traditional versus more online and beyond. Infrastructure cost. The learning platform, as we call it, is only partially built as we speak, and it is dynamic and evolving. We have already spent over $26 million, and that's an annual figure, on our learning platform, which would include and supports of the people, the equipment, the networks, the storage that we're speaking of. All costs, as the colleagues previous to my remarks have mentioned, almost all of these costs are upfront costs that you have to put them in first before you can begin to see how the experiment plays out. A couple of cost numbers that might help put this in context, as you can see from our slide on your handout. MyU costs something like $1.8 million in upfront costs. The Digital Campus and the Minnesota Learning Commons near $1 million. Just the Minnesota Learning Commons alone, we have put in $2.5 million for three different interfaces. I want to mention a couple of unique, I think, experiments that we have going on at the university in two areas, and my colleague will underscore those in his remarks. First, nursing, and second, occupational therapy. And this goes to the senator's remarks about cost, just using a couple of experiments. In examples, nursing. We have, on average, spent $23,000 per course to bring online and e-learning through our nursing program. Over the course of a relatively short time now, 225 courses in nursing, we have spent nearly $3 million in upfront costs for those particular courses. And in our nursing college, our students can get a whole array of opportunities through e-education. Why would one want to invest such enormous costs up front? Well, the previous speakers, I think, have answered this very ably. Convenience to students, a new generation of students that perhaps are more technologically sophisticated than maybe some of us were coming through. Different expectations that students now demand, perhaps less demand on classrooms as we go forward. And Dr. Finnegan will pick up on this theme when he talks about these blended theories of education. The slide that is presented in your handout on page 4, I think, tries to capture, and I hope this will help understand much of what the previous speakers were speaking of when it goes directly to the question of costs. If you look at that slide that I hope captures the components to the delivery, the faculty members' time in creating and thinking and developing the course, the designer who has to think about the design and how that is put together, a course coordinator, the use of the libraries, and the research that must go into the substance that's being delivered in the course, the graphic artist that will make this all come alive, the video expert who will capture it for the student and the delivery, the web developer who oversees the integration of the substance and the research and the faculty members' thinking, and then, of course, out to the learner himself or herself. These all have enormous costs associated with them, and I think that's part of your questions in trying to understand what I was hearing earlier about, can we quantify a net gain or loss here? Each one of these are significant components to help us understand the net gain or loss as we develop e-education. Teaching online has very different time commitments for faculty. Again, I think this goes to one of your questions about cost. A faculty member, quite frankly, can handle a lot more students in the traditional classroom that we know, perhaps 100, perhaps 500 in a biology classroom, rather than the maximum or perhaps the optimal number of students on an e-education or online course, 25 to perhaps 35 students. That's a big difference when you think about costs, when we think about economies of scale, both in the initial upfront costs, the sunk costs, as well as the delivering and in the implementation costs. We are piloting on two of our campuses, the frontiers of this now, the Rochester campus that you're familiar with and our Crookston campus. I think one of the bottom lines here is that e-education, online education, whatever you want to term it, is not inexpensive. And it does not, and I believe cannot, replace in a substantial way the need for the buildings, the laboratories, the traditional libraries. And I would emphasize, importantly, the personal interaction between the faculty member and the student. For those of you who have been teachers, you know that wonderful dynamic in the classroom that takes place between the teacher and the student and the mentoring we hope that takes place. I doubt that there is anyone in this room today who hasn't had the opportunity to have a mentor and a role model help him or her through. I'm not suggesting that online can't do that, but it certainly is easier in terms of access, in terms of oversight, to have the faculty member in charge throughout all of the development of our courses.
Madam Chair, excuse me.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question, if I might. As we're trying to get our minds around where the costs are related to online learning and in e-education, and I'm looking at the graphic that you gave us here, and I, my question kind of gets back to the previous questions we've asked about why does it cost so much for online learning. It seems to me that in traditional course development, you still need some of the same elements here that you're attributing to online learning expense. We still need librarians in a traditional classroom, course development, the course coordinator, the instructional design, the faculty member. What seems so these elements that you pointed out are not exclusive to e-education. So I'm a little confused as to why, if we're trying to understand just additional expenses to e-learning, I can see where the bottom line is very relevant, but we need to separate those some of those costs out, because if we're going to do side-by-side comparisons, we need to factor out the things that they have in common and look at where the differences are. So I don't know if I'm presenting the question in a way.
Madam Chair, Senator, if I could respond, absolutely correct in your understanding of the delivery of education. The time commitment for the faculty is probably going to be greater with the e-education. The infrastructure that this diagram attempts to depict will be substantially greater. For example, I have taught for 25 years in the classroom. I've probably had over 2,400 students in that period of time. There was no designer. I didn't have a course coordinator. Of course, I used the library, and I certainly hope my students did as well. There was no graphic artist. I didn't have anyone videotaping either presentations or preparations or the actual class. There was no web developer. And so these are new tools to help bring that e-education to us. But I think you'll see that those are substantial incremental costs associated with the teaching. And I would like to go on and just explain how some of those costs factor in, if I might.
I think Senator Sharon had a question that was relevant here,
yes,
too.
Yes, if you don't mind, if it's being stimulated as you're talking. And you described a number of that make up this expense of $23,000 per course. Did I understand that correctly? All of those elements that go into designing, creating the course, the support that goes behind the course that the faculty member teaches. Correct?
Yes.
My question about that is we should not assume that once that $23,000 is expended on those, what did you call them, platform costs, that that would, that's done now and we won't have to go back to those costs again. It's not a one-time $23,000 expenditure. That's one question. The second question I have for is I'm just starting to think about that kind of an investment in a course, and I'm a faculty member now replacing another faculty member, want to redesign a course. Is that another $23,000 expenditure? Third, even if I'm not leaving, if I want to update and innovate and create new innovations for my online course, am I discouraged from doing that because of the economics? And then the fourth question is, is it probable that if some courses, like those that are taught to 200 students or 300 students, or you know, I can't imagine that, but I'd have flunked out, I'll tell you that, but that some courses lend themselves better to what we're talking about here, advanced courses or courses that are in the later years where the classroom size is smaller anyway. Those are my four questions.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator Pappas and Senator. With regard to your first question on the cost, you are correct. I was speaking of the average costs associated with building the platform, as you call it correctly. There are, in every circumstances, ongoing annual costs for monitoring, oversight, and updating of. To your second question, anytime you would change the platform, the format, and particularly we hope the content as the substance changes and the knowledge we know about that, there would be additional cost increases. To your third question, I think it goes to economies of scale, and those, of course, will vary on the nature of the course and the amount of interaction and interconnectivity required of all of these people in the diagram in front of you. And with regard to your fourth question,
which was about some courses are better suited to this than other courses.
Madam Chair, yes. And we will describe that in a moment when we get into the specifics of some of these blended opportunities in the courses that we've mentioned. But to be sure, you're correct. The nature of the course, the amount of research, updating, faculty time and oversight, not only in preparing the course, during the course, but after, grading, et cetera, all of that adds into it, and that will vary on the nature of. My colleague, the dean, will be able to, I think, give examples in his own College of Public Health on a course-based specific, how that cost may vary depending upon the nature of the course and the kind of research that's connected, in our case, to the learning platform in that course. I might mention, because cost is a major policy concern, to be sure, as well as operational, when I was coming over this morning, I was thinking about analogies to help us here. And the closest analogy, I hope it's apt, it may not be perfect, and that is to libraries and our digitalization of library materials. Many years ago, when we came into the technology age, we all thought, particularly those of us in administration and managing budgets, that with the advent of an opportunity to digitalize our library collection, this would reduce the costs substantially. We wouldn't need as large buildings, we wouldn't need more libraries or additions to libraries, we could cut down on the hard copy budgets, etc. We have been proven wrong so far on that. The analogy here is that you have to have that interconnectedness between, in this case, the library and the research component, with the e-education or online class. The analogy is that now in library budgets, you have to continue to buy the hard copies because so many materials and subject matter are not and will not be in digital form. And at the same time, you need to expand on the digital side of your library materials. So right now, we have two budgets going on in our libraries, and they are both growing, unfortunately. And I hope that's not a perfect example for e-education. But if you believe that there needs to be a blend between the traditional, depending upon the expectations of the student, perhaps the generation of the student, from traditional in-class as well as online experience, I think at least initially in the short term, as is suggested by our library example, the costs will increase. There will not be great savings. In the long term, there may be. I don't think there is anyone in this room or anyone I know or who have read that can tell us with any quantitative precision what the net cost is going to be here for e-education. We can hypothesize, we can guess, we can attempt to surmise. We cannot give you that number. We can't tell you today what the net cost savings will be down the road. We wish we could. It's too evolving. It's too new, I think, in the evolution of, particularly when you're doing side-by-side education as we are, the traditional format as it evolves as well as e-education. One wonderful example in addition to our nursing school that I mentioned is our occupational therapy program. To answer an earlier question, of all of our students who have gone through the e-education in nursing or occupational therapy, 100% have completed the courses. We have here a blend. We have here a hybrid, students having opportunities to take courses more traditionally oriented or in the e-education orientation. But in our occupational therapy program that's now becoming a model in the country, this has very much moved in the direction of e-education, away from the more traditional classroom experiences. But clearly in this subject matter, there has to be a strong one-on-one component for the clinical observation and the clinical experiences. We have 20 courses identified on the web. Courses ranging all the way from primarily based web all the way through a blend and a mixture of the traditional and the web. Course development for a primary online courses takes, and I think this goes to the cost question, 6 months to deliver, to design, to implement one course in occupational therapy. For two or three credit courses, it is 242 faculty credit hours to design and to credit a two or three credit course in occupational therapy. Again, some of those hidden costs that don't appear on the surface.
Provost Solomon, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to be sure we get to Dr. Finnegan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What our slides in your packet are showing are the different variety and the variations of how we handle e-education at the university, starting with the digital campus that's pointed out there on your slide. Again, experimentation going on in the Rochester and the Crookston campus. And in each of these, we come back to one of my themes, which is how do we design a curriculum and a teaching learning experience for students that will attempt to be a blend in terms of the segment in the market, in this case the student, whether it's an 18-year-old, more traditional student coming to the university, or, as the previous speakers have spoken so well, the adult learner who is out of and perhaps not near a university or college setting. All of that has to be taken into account. We have, at the university, as you know, 66,000 students in our system, and we have that full range or continuum from the 18-year-old right out of high school to the PhD student, and we are attempting to manage over 17,000 courses in the university with 66,000 students to find an optimal balance and blend between the traditional and the online to make sure that that is a an important educational experience for our students. Let me just summarize with a couple of numbers that might help, again, explain the context for both the public policy that you must lead on as well as the costs associated with that. I mentioned a moment ago the university has 17,000 courses offered across and for 66,000 students. Last year online, we had nearly 1,700 courses with 21,000 students engaged on e-education or online experiences. This is an increase of 154% for the course offerings and over 146% in the number of students taking online courses. I would like to just summarize my remarks in a second or two and turn to my colleague and underscore that this is a very complicated area that you know well in terms of its complexity. We have to make prudent investments, particularly at a time of very severe constrained resources at the state level and throughout our state. Each of our institutions, a point I made earlier in my remarks, each of our institutions has a distinctive, unique mission, and each of us have comparative advantages. And it would be a strategic mistake if we did not try to align our strengths and comparative advantages with opportunities for e-education as they're blended and integrated into a more traditional view. But I think that's a very important part of what we're attempting to do at the university as we foster new partnerships with our partners in the state, both nonprofit and profit institutions. If I could ask my colleague, Dean Finnegan, to just share a couple of examples in his experience at the School of Public Health.
Dean Finnegan, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota is part of the Academic Health Center, and that's composed of the six schools and colleges that include medicine, pharmacy, dentistry, veterinary medicine, nursing, and public health, as well as programs on the Duluth campus as well. And my school has made investments in e-learning for about the past 10 years or so. And it has made possible the increase in the number of students that we have been able to serve from about 350 in 1999 to today, 1,350. I won't say that technology has been the only reason for that increase, but it has been a huge impact, essentially, on our ability to reach professionals and others in the graduate and professional arena as far as public health is concerned. One of the things that Provost Sullivan mentioned that I think is important to understand is that this is about more than only online learning. There is another key trend, which we believe is equally important, which we call blended learning. In other words, this is the use of these new forms of technology essentially blended into the traditional classroom setting. And some of the use of this is really dependent on our better understanding of learning styles, our better understanding of what kinds of technology can do a better job of providing the learner with the right kind of experience. That is an area, as Provost Sullivan indicated, that is emerging as far as the research is concerned, but it's extraordinarily important as we go forward. In my school, for example, 100% of the courses that we offer make use of technology in some form. It may be something as crude as having the syllabus of every single course in an online format, or it may be something as complex as a virtual environment within which a student needs to decide or needs to make decisions based on problem situations that are presented to them. As far as our online education is concerned, it is now possible for people to take a Master's of Public Health degree in maternal and child health, for example, from a distance, in combination with a brief stay in the summer here during our Public Health Institute. And so right now, in any given semester, about 35 to 40% of our students are taking an online course. So anywhere from about 500 to 550 or so of our students in any given semester. And many of them are taking more than one course at a time. The last thing I'd say is that I think Provost Sullivan has made a very good point about the issue of cost when we look at this. You can buy an expensive car, you can buy a more basic car, but the car isn't useful unless you've got a road system on which to drive it. And so when we talk about the issues of e-learning and online education, it's not only about the issue of what does it cost to develop a course, and that will vary depending on a variety of the characteristics that you play with in the development of that course, but it also depends on that delivery channel, so to speak, what you've got out there. Maybe we're not so worried about that in the Twin Cities area or large metropolitan areas. We seem to have a lot of redundancy in the development of high-speed delivery. That may not be so true when we talk about greater Minnesota. And that may be an area where infrastructure, similar to what we needed to do in the 30s with rural electrification, that may still be an important area where we will need to think as a state about the development. So I will stop there, Madam Chair, and answer any questions people may have.
Okay, Senator Roebling, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering about the transfer of credits. Now we just had Capella here. If they had students who had taken courses through their programs or another online university, how do you look at those if those students are coming into your system and finishing their degree?
Madam Chair, and Senator, if I could respond to that. As you well know, we've had for a long time articulation agreements between the university and the Minscu system. I think those are across all courses. Those are working well. And to your question of Capella University or other providers, we are working out those agreements and certainly receptive to working out more agreements with other institutions in the transferability of credits toward to the University of Minnesota.
Dean Finnegan.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, in the School of Public Health, we would handle that transfer. This is in graduate or professional training. We would handle that transfer similar to the way we handle transfer right now. In other words, we would look at the course. We would evaluate the course. I would ask a group of our faculty to take a look at it and to decide if the course is of a sufficient level that it merits the kind of credit that and then we would give it that credit if it does merit that. And we allow in our program, for example, up to 15 credits of external coursework to be ported into our program. We do have limits there because, as most programs at the university and the professional and graduate level would have limits about how many courses. But that is not because it is Capella or online or anything. That would simply be that's the limit that we allow to port into our degree program. And why we have that limit is that at some point we have to say, well, if this is the University of Minnesota giving a degree, then the majority of those credits should be taken and certified by the University of Minnesota. So that's the reason here. We would treat online credits, as you described, in exactly the same way we treat other types of credits right now.
Senator Roebling.
I just wanted to ask about attendance. I know, especially in undergraduate programs, a lot of students who have 8 or 9 in the morning classes don't always show up. And do you find it different for students taking online courses? And what happens if they aren't? I mean, is it completely up to them to keep up with the work, or are they checking in? How do you track attendance, and is it better or worse than a typical classroom?
Dean Finnegan.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's actually easier to track attendance for online courses, I think, in many ways. It certainly doesn't take as much time because, you've got a very good roster and you know who's done what assignments and when and if they haven't. And this is one of the things that I think we learned early on in this experience a decade ago. We do have some coordinators who will actually help our faculty you know, contact the student if assignments are not getting done. We need to know why. One of the biggest issues, I think, in online learning is being able to follow up with the student and not let them fall through the cracks. And so for us, we've taken steps to assure that that doesn't happen. So in many ways, I would say compliance with learning is actually better in the online world than sometimes it is at the course that's offered at 8 o'clock in the morning, where sometimes the faculty member's not very awake either.
Okay, Senator Tomasoni.
I only had one of those 8 o'clock courses. That was my first quarter. But
learn your lesson.
Did I hear you right, Dean Finnegan, that there's like 500 kids enrolled at the campus that are taking online courses also? Is that what I heard you say?
Dean Finnegan?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that's in my school.
In your school?
I have 1,350 students in my school, and looking over, for example, the last couple of semesters, at any given time, we have about between 500 and 550 of our students taking online courses.
From the U?
From us.
From your department.
And do they get that credit break that you get at 15 credits or whatever it is at the U if they're going over that?
Yes.
And so why are they taking the online courses as opposed to, I mean, as long as they're enrolled at the U, why are they taking the online courses as opposed to the
Dean Finnegan
going to regular classrooms?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, in part because it's possible to, many of our students are not doing anything between midnight and 3 a.m., and it is possible for them to actually add another course. It allows them to time shift things in a way frequently that you can't do in the traditional arena. I might also add, by the way, I did not describe that we do offer about 20 dual degree options across the University of Minnesota, for example, with the law school, medical school, nursing, and many other schools. And so we have students in quite a number of professional and graduate programs that while they're doing a law degree are also seeking to complete a master's in public health. So the online effort that we've made has really made that much, much more possible for them to do in a reasonable period of time without adding several more years of time spent at the university.
Okay, we're going to take one more question, and then we have one more testifier, and we're going to try to adjourn a little early today. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. This has been a really helpful and informative discussion we're having today on e-education. I want to comment on something I heard both of you gentlemen say that is really exciting, I think. We talked about the art of education, and you both have said that different students learn differently, and we're talking about different learning styles. But I haven't heard a lot about how online courses are being tailored to include students that may have very great IQs, but different learning styles, and sometimes even be in the learning disabled group as they move forward. It seems to me that online learning is particularly geared towards people who learn visually, because you're doing lots of reading and lots of writing. How are we including the disability community, and not only that, but learning disabilities with what we know about them?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator, we have a very active disability organization at the university, and it has been very active in the education program, and particularly assisting us in things such as universal access and so forth. We also have a very active Center for Learning Technology Center for Learning and Teaching, I should say, which has been very helpful and supportive of faculty in their understanding of these of different learning styles. I would be overstating if I were to tell you that the research is at a stage where we can be so specific to match a learning style with a specific kind of vehicle for carrying that information. But that kind of research is, in fact, beginning to emerge, and I would say that the future would portend much more of this kind of activity in the not-too-distant future as well.
Madam Chair, Senator, Provost if Sullivan. I could just supplement for a minute. I think that's a very important question in terms of also not only the public policy implications that you were suggesting, but the cost. That, as John was referring to, that is a very important office and function at our university. that also has a substantial cost factor that on page 4 of your outline I think should be factored in as well. All the different resources that the faculty member consults in building and designing and delivering, if you ask what's the cost, all of those are really direct costs that should be looked at. But a very important part of how you build, monitor, for the comment that the student before us so ably mentioned, the quality control over the course to make sure that each of our institutions are carrying out their obligation for effective teaching and learning in an attempt to preserve and expand the diversification of teaching styles to meet our students' needs in the context of our university missions. I think you've identified a very important element of that.
Thank you.
And with that, we'd like to thank you both very much for spending the afternoon with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week. Perhaps.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
While Mr. Stanton is coming up, members, we are going to the University of Minnesota next week, and I hope you all can join us for lunch because the university is going to give a presentation to us during lunch. And so, Ms. Ryan, we're leaving, as usual, at 11:15. And then we'll be back by 2:30, 2:45, something like that. Mr. Stanton, briefly.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That is the faculty, 3,300 faculty at the state universities. The folks that I represent are the people who develop the MinSQ courses online. They're the people who teach the courses online and see firsthand what works and what does not work. I'm glad I was able to get back. I just got back from the inauguration, and I didn't see the agenda until just a few hours ago. But we do have some concerns. Generally speaking, on behalf of the faculty, I would say that they like teaching online. Some of them love teaching online. They have every incentive to teach online. They reach new audiences. They boost enrollment. They actually get paid more if they teach online as an incentive. I can assure you that if there is demand out there for online education, the faculty would be more than willing to meet that demand. However, they would urge some caution. Online, people have kind of, over the last decade and a half, kind of gone gaga over online education. And have not been real rational in their analysis of it. First of all, it costs more money. It is not the cost saver that people thought it was going to be. You still have a faculty member in front of the class, and the cost of the faculty member is by far the largest cost of delivering a course. And online courses, because they're more cumbersome in many ways, you have to have smaller student-faculty ratios, and that really drives up cost dramatically. We pushed this issue for some time, and MinSQ did an internal study, and they said, well, online is about the same in cost as a traditional course. But in that study, they only assumed that they assumed that the indirect costs of online education were the same as for other courses, and they're simply not. Anyone, I mean, this committee certainly knows you've pumped tons of money into technology over the last few years to support that, and those indirect costs are much higher. There's some talk about capital savings. I've watched the bonding bills for several decades around here as online developed. I haven't seen any change in capital requests since online came along. Oftentimes, online education can reduce the efficiency of classroom instruction. Because if a course is being offered online, sometimes the student sits in their pajamas in the dorm and takes it, and there's fewer students, a smaller class size for the in-class course, and that reduces its efficiency in terms of courses. And we're concerned about quality control. And, you know, some of our own faculty have been violators. You know, there was a story up at St. Cloud State University a couple years ago, a faculty member making close to $250,000 teaching online because of the incentives that were offered. There is simply no way that faculty member can teach that many students to generate that much money and have any meaningful interaction with those students. They're just pumping that stuff out if they're doing it that much of it. And we have very, very serious control concerns about having some quality controls on online education. We're concerned about that a lot of the you need to have a policy dealing with the delivery of online education outside of Minnesota. Much of the online education that is being produced is being sent to places like Detroit or Toronto or places like that. And keep in mind, half of the cost of producing this is picked up by Minnesota taxpayers. These people, it's different than a student that comes here from out of state and goes to school here. There's a chance they'll stay here. But these students that are taking the courses never paid taxes in Minnesota. They probably will never live in Minnesota or contribute to our economy. And I think...
Well, Mr. Stanton, don't they have to pay non-resident tuition?
They some do. Some pay the regular tuition. And if they're paying the full cost, then there's nothing wrong with it. That really, I think, needs to be examined. Two more points. One is we would like people, when they consider online education, to remember that 90% of the courses that students take, 90% of the education that is being delivered, still takes place in a traditional classroom setting. And that's the core of our operation, and that we shouldn't neglect that by devoting too much resources to developing online. Finally, we believe that online education should be expanded to meet market demand. This isn't the Soviet Union where a government authority determines what people need or want. This is, you know, an American free market system, and where we need to expand to meet what the demand is out there. And therefore, we would strongly support expanding online education as fast as students want it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your comments. I appreciate it. And hope you had a good time at the inaugural, and the committee is adjourned.